This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. And on today's show, you're going to get to meet Julia Hartz. Julia is the co-founder and president of Eventbrite. It's a website where you get to create events of your own and market them in some really creative ways. I met Julia because she was on a panel that I moderated for the Girls in Technology conference called Catalyst. She was awesome. I immediately took a liking to her and, of course, invited her onto Dishy Mix so we could learn more about the world of events and marketing. So let's get her on the show. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. We had a good session at that Girls in Technology conference, I thought.
We really did. It was a great group of women, and I had so much fun being on the panel, especially having you moderate. That was really fun, and it was very different.
What made it different for you?
Well, I really loved your creative line of questioning and the preparation we went through, just chatting beforehand and sharing ideas, and the way you brought them to life on stage was so great and so engaging, especially since we were the first panel to go. So it was, I think, 9 in the morning and everybody was a little blurry-eyed, but you just, I really loved your energy and I loved how you engaged everyone in the audience and as well as us up on stage.
Well, thank you. I was actually not asking you I wasn't asking you that to get a compliment. Well, now I'm a little embarrassed. I thought maybe it was something different than that. But yeah, we had to wake people up. And you know what I thought was funny too? It was perfect for you because as co-founder and president of Eventbrite, the thing that the key takeaway that I got out of our session was that everybody on our panel talked about how offline events were the single most important thing they were doing in marketing. And hello, there you were saying, well, you should have those with Eventbrite.
We were really fortunate to be the ticketing partner for that event. And so it was also fantastic to look out and realize that everybody there had bought a ticket on Eventbrite. That was really special. It never gets old for me.
Oh, well, and you have a beautiful viral business that way. So give us a couple of the stats on Eventbrite for someone who maybe hasn't used an offline event and created it with Eventbrite or even an online. It doesn't have to be an offline event. It can be an online event. It could be a webinar that you do, right? So talk to us about Eventbrite. Just give us the highlights.
Sure. So Eventbrite was founded in 2006 by myself and my husband, Kevin Hartz, and our third co-founder, Renaud Visage, who is our CTO. And basically what we were trying to do was tap into this incredible industry of events. And when you say events, you can be speaking about, grandma's knitting club all the way up to a 5,000 person tech conference or a rave. I mean, it's really incredible and horizontal in nature. And so there are a million different verticals that you can think of. And basically anything that you can think of that you would sell a ticket to or gather people around is really right in our wheelhouse. And so that was really exciting. First and foremost, the opportunity. But second of all, we really saw that this industry in particular was very stagnant and had a lack of technology. And as technologists, this was a great challenge for us, how we've tackled this problem and the pain points that event organizers were having. And so really what we're trying to answer is, as an event organizer, how can you use technology to make your life easier and to sell more tickets to your event? And obviously that's a pretty simple question to say, but it's very complicated in execution and very nuanced. And so what we've been working on for the last 4 years is making the best product possible to offer event organizers a way to create, promote, and sell out their events online and really take a complicated and sort of anxiety-ridden process and make it really simple and have really easy answers at the end of the day and results to show for it. And so We were founded in 2006, and I can give you some stats on 2009. We had over 24 million unique visitors, which was a 200% year-over-year growth for us. We really saw a great year of growth last year. We had over 150,000 events sell a free or paid ticket on Eventbrite, which was a great achievement for us. And ultimately, the paid events generated $100 million in gross ticket sales. And so at the end of the day, we were able to help event organizers, you know, receive $100 million in gross ticket sales in aggregate over 2009. And that was extremely exciting for us. That was our goal, and we were able to achieve it.
It's a really impressive set of statistics. The 150,000 events that you had, what were the big clusters of events?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. In our business currently, so we have, as I mentioned, a very wide and varied subset of users. So it's incredible because there are really no averages and there are really no majorities in the way that we've built Eventbrite, which is an interesting challenge because a lot of times growth is seen through vertical concentration or from, you know, basically exploring one vertical and getting the model right and then applying that to another vertical. For us, we created this agnostic system. So this platform where anybody and everybody could use it, it's one size fits all. And we've had this tremendous growth almost the hard way, which is it's sort of mind-boggling when you think about it. But if I were to have to sort of force rank the top verticals or like our sweet spot, I would say that, you know, conferences, seminars, workshops, and social events would be up there in the top four. Maybe fundraisers could be number five. It changes all the time. So, you know, it's definitely not in that order. But those are some of the top verticals. So some of the top sets and categories of users who are using Eventbrite currently. But there's, you know, I think in our product, there's probably 30 different categories that you could use to categorize your event.
It's funny, one of the products that I'm publishing right now, I'm co-creating a downloadable, I call them ebooks with benefits. They're called information products, but not everyone knows what that is.
Sure.
The product I'm creating with Jamie is called Intimate Party Ideas. And it's actually where you can have a party at your house. You know how, have you ever had a party at your house where you've maybe had a dinner party and you've had, you know, another couple or a couple of couples or a group of friends come over and you just had really great intimate conversation? And when they went home, you were like, that was a great party. Have you ever had that?
Absolutely. Not so much right now since we're working so hard.
And you're working and you have Emma, you've got your little girl, but you know what I mean. Everybody knows, right? Well, what we're creating is downloadable book that teaches you, first of all the kind of basics of having people over, you know, how you manage it, how you budget, how you cook for it, all kinds of like process oriented stuff. But then party games where we have all these different games that you can play with your friends that kind of take it beyond just the random conversation where you hope it'll be fun and turn it into something that makes it fun, you know, takes kind of the table topics to the next level.
That's a really great idea.
It is. And people crave that intimacy with their friends. And, you know, our time is precious and it takes so much effort to put an event on that when you finally get people gathered, you want it to be awesome. So we're kind of front loading the deck with this Intimate Party Ideas product. It's not launched yet, but you talked a lot about the conferences, the seminars, the workshops. It doesn't really matter whether you're having six people over to your house or you're, you know, having a huge seminar. There are some things that you can do when you invite people that take that fear out of it for you as the giver and them maybe as the RSVP-er. What are some of those things that you see people doing on Eventbrite that you know are kind of the best practices for making it work?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of it revolves around how you promote the event. And it's really interesting because, you know, obviously when we launched our product, we launched with an email invitation tool that was, again, another product that's extremely simple at face value, but a very nuanced and complex on the back end when you talk about, you know, email deliverability and user behavior and what creates the best conversion. So that is all the work we're doing on the back end, but giving our user the really simple interface to send out a very effective email invitation to their users and to their fans. But beyond, way beyond that. So that's sort of the starting point. And then we created tools around how can you effectively find potential attendees online. So we are, when you press publish on Eventbrite, we are doing a few things automatically, again, on the back end that you don't even see as the event organizer, that allows you to reach a wider audience, which is, we have a great, you know, SEO machine that basically gets your event page highly ranked in the search indexes, not just Google. And we have, partnerships with event aggregation sites where your event will show up if somebody is searching on, let's say, San Francisco Friday night. And then we also provide tools where you can proactively publish promotion tools on your own site. So a lot of times you may have your own blog, your own fan page, even maybe your own website for that event or your organization, and we give you little snippets of code, you know, things, little widgets that you can customize on our side, and then you can drag and drop them essentially into your own website or your blog or your fan page. Then beyond that is really where it gets interesting, and what we're extremely excited about is the intersection of events and social media. So basically, how do we share information, and how do we share events that we are attending and get others to attend as well? And where do we find a hyper relevant audience? Well, that's really through your social or your professional graph. And basically that's what we've tapped into, you know, starting in mid 2008 was really when we saw this inflection point, where people were sharing information across Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter. And we were really able to get in there and capitalize, and we're continuing to iterate on this, and help event organizers and attendees find more people to attend events and share those events. And that is extremely, extremely valuable. And so, you know, when you talk about sort of best practices, I would say as an event organizer, you know, first you're going to want to, you know, get the right content and the venue and the vendors, and that's a whole nother beast. But really, when you're talking about getting people in the door and filling those seats, you really want to look at what is the most effective way to promote your event, and where are you really going to find that relevancy? And again, that I keep coming back to that because it's very, very, very clear that hyper-relevant information is extremely valuable. So you'll see a higher conversion rate there.
You just raised your Series B for Eventbrite, yes, and you just did a press tour. So how much did you raise on your Series B?
We raised $7 million from Sequoia Capital. Roelof Botha.
Okay.
You just made me say his name. Oh,
yeah. you did a good job. And you went on a press tour. Now, where was your press tour?
So we did an East Coast press tour, and it was pretty opportunistic. This is very much in line with how Kevin and I operate. So we've been very heads down and doing absolutely no press. And Kevin and I together are the worst salespeople on the earth. We couldn't sell you money. So that's kind of in line with how we sort of self-promote, which is basically none until a few months ago. And so when we went out and raised our Series B, we received such great reception and so many amazing ideas. We were able to kind of, for the first time, raise our heads up. You know, we'd been heads down working on product for 3 years. We were able to look around, understand the landscape. It was a great time to just sort of pause and take stock of what is the market in itself, and then also what we have achieved. And it really became clear that we have a very strong story. And I think that when you go out and fundraise and you're talking about your company over and over and over again, a story organically comes together. So that's really where it began, is telling our story over and over. And you know, you get into a lot of detail, and especially with Sequoia and especially with Roelof, we were able to really explore every in and out of our business. And so we decided that it would be a great time to go out and start talking to others and just raising the brand awareness and telling our story. And so we had an invitation to speak at MIT and to do some networking and recruiting there, which is very important to us. And so we decided that, you know, as parents of a two-year-old and co-founders of startup, we don't do a ton of traveling. And so we get to the East Coast about once a year. And so we decided to really capitalize on that trip and make, you know, again, sort of capital efficiency was key as well. So we decided to get out and talk to the media on the East Coast. And it was an amazing experience because, you know, we're very sort of West Coast centric in our day to day. We're very, you know, steeped in the valley. And so it was really amazing to get out and speak to other people that we hadn't spoken to before.
Who were some of the people that you pitched?
We pitched, we spoke to about 18 different outlets in 2 days, and all over Manhattan, if you can imagine, the cab fare on that. It was incredible. But
You should get a car service from now on. They're always waiting for you.
We learned the hard way.
It's cheaper.
Exactly. We definitely learned the hard way.
We're surprised your PR firm didn't know that.
So we spoke to everybody from, you know, the New York Times, which was like, we had such a geek out moment there, you know, taking pictures in front of the doors and whatnot, to Inc. magazine. They were amazing and definitely, I'd say interested in sort of the human aspect of our story. We also spoke to Wired and we spoke to some other sort of more niche players in music and live entertainment. And those are the ones I can remember offhand, but I'm definitely forgetting some important meetings that we had, but they were all,
don't worry. I'm sure they're
extremely valuable.
Okay. So before we go to a break, you have a present for Dishy Mix fans. Tell us what you have for us today.
I do. Well, we would love to offer to Dishy Mix fans, a lucky fan, a first event free. So that means that you can host an event on Eventbrite and try out all the bells and whistles at no cost. And we're very excited to introduce our service to a Dishy Mix fan and help them hold a successful event.
Thank you so much for doing that. So if you're a Dishy Mix listener and you would like to try Eventbrite, you haven't done it before, and you are thinking about putting together an event and you'd like to have all of the fees waived, just go to DishyMixFan.com. That's the Facebook fan page for the show. Or you can go into Facebook and you can just search for Dishy Mix, all one word. You'll find us, post your desire and your event, some information about yourself on the page. And Julia and I will choose one of you and you'll get a free event on Eventbrite. We're going to go to a break to thank my sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a lot of other things, including some efficiency tricks, Julia's mentor, and the fact that she used to be in the television programming world. We're going to get the inside scoop on TV programming. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Julia Hartz of Eventbrite. This is Susan Bratton, author of the Talk Show Tips System. If you're a podcaster, information product marketer, blogger, radio, or TV host, and you conduct interviews, Talk Show Tips can turn your audience into raving fans who promote your work for you. Talk Show Tips 72 Secret Master Host Techniques teaches you how to prepare and produce riveting interviews. And learn how to promote your work with free social influence marketing strategies. Want to know how to effortlessly generate killer questions for your next interview? Get my free easy question generator mini course today at talkshowtips.com. We're back. I'm your host, Susan Bratton, and we're getting to know Julia Hartz. She's the co-founder and president of Eventbrite. So, Julia, there was another thing that triggered my mind just before we were going to a break. Do you do something around nonprofits?
Yes, we do. Thank you so much for teeing that up, Susan. We actually, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, if this is a coincidence, but we just released Eventbrite for Causes, which is... Oh, you just did my job for me. So it really stemmed out of not only do numerous amounts of nonprofits use Eventbrite just organically because it is so easy to use. It's cost effective, and it also reaches a wider audience to promote awareness of the cause. But, you know, we have everybody from, you know, a small sort of unknown charity to the Craigslist Foundation to a great local charity that we're very involved with called Full Circle Fund here in San Francisco. And we like to talk to our customers. We like to get to know them and we like to get to know what their needs are. And so we created this program not only to support nonprofit fundraising efforts through events by giving them a discounted rate on Eventbrite, but also to really start to create a community around nonprofit fundraising through events. And so that's sort of a niche in itself, but I think it's very valuable to differentiate this program from just a discounted rate and off you go. It's more of an effort to really hear and understand the pain points and the points of view from nonprofit fundraisers, because I feel like it's extremely unique, and their challenges and pain points are not necessarily the same as everyone else's. And I feel like we have a real opportunity to provide not only thought leadership, but a community element to really help these organizers share ideas and support each other and really learn how they can effectively fundraise through events. And so the program is a lot more than just the discounted rate. It's sort of in development, and it definitely requires user participation, but we hope to, in 6 months from now, have this incredible nonprofit fundraising portal for event organizers.
That's great. And sharing best practices with them so that they can sell out their events to raise money.
Exactly.
I like
exactly.
it. One of the Eileen Gittens, who was on our panel at the Girls in Technology Conference, the Catalyst Conference from Blurb, she was on a couple of episodes ago. And one of the things that we did was give away a couple of Blurb books. And one of them we gave to a DishyMix listener who is at a small community college, I think in Washington. And he wrote in and said that he was going to, if he won the Blurb book, what he was going to do was take images from all around the campus and give it to the person at his community college who did a lot of the fundraising for the college so that they could use it as almost as a selling feature when they went out to raise money. And so you're doing a similar thing with cause marketing with your product, which I think is awesome.
Thank you.
So you made the switch from Hollywood to Silicon Valley. You came from the network, the world of television, network television. You call yourself a reformed television network executive. And I know you worked at FX Networks.
Yes.
And you supervised The Shield, NASCAR Drivers 360, Nip Tuck, Rescue Me, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. What was it that you did? You were on the creative side. What did you do?
Sure. So a lot of what I did at MTV and at FX were there's an analogy there to a VC in Silicon Valley. So as a development executive, we would hear pitches day in and day out. I mean, dozens of pitches a day sometimes from creative people, whether it be writers, producers, actors, actresses, etc. And we would get pitched ideas for shows, and we would decide which ones to purchase for the network. And then we would help develop those shows. So we would sometimes be called the suits, but it was this really incredible marriage of both business and creative, which I didn't even know existed until I did, maybe six different internships throughout college. I interned every single semester, sometimes two internships a semester, and really found my perfect groove, which was this development executive position that was this perfect blend of business and creative. So there's a development executive, and then there's a current executive. And at FX, I was a current executive, and that's where you are overseeing the current shows on the air. And so I was working day in and day out with the teams on each show and approving, the cuts and everything else that goes into making and promoting a great show and providing success on the network. And it was incredible. I mean, it was an incredible experience and one I'll treasure. And I hope to keep the memories in my head.
So two of my favorites, Rescue Me and Nip Tuck. Give us a story about one or the other of them that we wouldn't ever know if we were just watching the show.
Oh gosh, what is the rating of your show? Is it PG-13 or is it?
Yeah, we're adults here. It's okay. You can say something that's a little off color. It's not a problem.
I think my mother taught me better than that.
Okay.
So for Rescue Me, I think that something that was really interesting is a lot of the guys on the show, an actual really surprising percentage amount of the actors on the show were actually firemen in a previous life. And so it was extremely authentic. And Dennis Leary was so incredibly passionate about the firefighter community. And he would literally go and spend days at a time in the firehouse in New York, and was just such a, has been like a huge fan his entire life. I think he wishes that he were actually a fireman instead of doing this acting thing. And then with Nip Tuck, I think that it was just one funny story is I would watch. So you get cuts as a network executive, and you get these sort of every day when they shoot, they send you what they shot, and you you can give notes based on that. And so I would often watch cuts while I was eating lunch at my desk. And I'm sure if you've watched Nip Tuck, you know that there's always one or two really gory scenes, surgery scenes. And so one day I was eating, I think, a burrito, and I literally almost passed out because it was just such a shocking scene that came up, and it was very raw. And so I went to the set the next day, and I told them that I wasn't sure if I could handle watching these scenes during lunch. And so they let me go behind the scenes and actually perform some surgeries. So I got to do like a liposuction, and I got to see everything sort of in real life and the special effects that go behind all the goriness. So it definitely helped curb that sort of gag reflex I had.
I have to turn my head at Nip Tuck. I actually don't watch it anymore. I don't even know if it's on anymore, but I can remember how it was just like incredibly graphic. No wonder you barfed your burrito.
Yeah, exactly. There's this great term in television called jumping the shark.
I felt like Rescue Me did that. I actually think they both did that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when it comes to Nip Tuck and I guess Rescue Me, we termed it humping the shark. It was just, it's just like, how many
women could Christian possibly have sex with?
Exactly.
I know. Humping the shark. I love that. And so was during your time as a development executive, was there ever a show that you got pitched that you knew wasn't right for FX, but that you loved and wished you could have brought to fruition?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like maybe I heard a great idea every month, and so one that stands out right away is I could have just been starstruck, but we had a meeting with Kevin Spacey. And so of course, when somebody like of that caliber would come in, and we met with a lot of sort of well-known people, but we'd have the whole team. Well, this particular day, everybody got like food poisoning or the flu or something happened where I was the only executive left standing, and I was the most junior executive on a team of like six guys and me. And so so I ended up being sort of the only executive, I think, in the room aside from like my boss's boss's boss. And it was just sort of Kevin and I talking. And his idea was to base a show around aspiring filmmakers and to just do a really, I don't remember the very specifics, but to just really leverage the making of a film from an organic perspective and from these incredibly talented up-and-coming rising stars and create this great show around that. And then also, there would be like this sort of contest aspect to it as well. But it would just came from, he's kind of a controversial character, but just sitting down and meeting with him, his passion for filmmaking was so palatable that I definitely would have died happy if I was able to work on that show.
And so how do you feel about being in the world of technology now instead of the world of television?
Well, I really love it. And I feel like, when I made the decision to basically quit my career in television and move to San Francisco, I knew in my gut it was the right decision. And I took the chance and I took the leap. But now 4 years out and looking back, I realize a lot about why I made the decision and why it was the right decision. And, in my last year in at FX and cable television, we were doing things that were extremely cutting edge on the creative side. But sort of logistically and on the business side, we were very much behind. And so most of my years in television were spent sort of chasing this thing called the internet and online distribution and understanding how to promote shows online. And it was very much of a struggle. And the advertising model was breaking. So I was spending also a lot of my time working on product placement, which is I just an incredible, I could go on and on about that, but basically making sure that Dennis held the, you know, the Budweiser can the right way and, you know, really kind of battling it out with these big brands. And so I was feeling like there was a missing link there. And really when I came to Silicon Valley, I realized what it was this sort of lack of technology or being ahead of the game. I always felt like I was 10 steps back. And now I feel so satisfied and so lucky to be on the cutting edge of technology, which I feel is so incredibly important in so many different ways. But it's just constantly exciting and reminds me that this was the correct decision for me.
When we're steeped in it, we forget. Yes. Almost where the rest of the world still is. I don't mean we're so far ahead, Bull, that we're so great. But when you are creating the technologies, there is a lag time where people still need to learn about how to really work with what you've created. Before we end the show, I want to talk to you about something that you've done with your parents. Before you launched Eventbrite, you told me you and Kevin went to Bangkok with your parents. Yes. To volunteer at an orphanage in the Klang Tui slums. Tell me more about how your parents got involved in that, what that experience was like for you, how other people might be able to help if that's something that they were thinking about. Orphanages anywhere. It doesn't have to be in Bangkok. But, you know, what's needed? What did you find out? How did it change your life? What can we do? What would you like to do in the future? Tell us that story.
Sure. So my parents are, I was born and raised in Santa Cruz. And so there's an element of my parents that could be called hippie. But they're just such lovely people who both felt very satisfied in their lives, yet felt they wanted to give back all the happiness that had been delivered to them. And so they, through the temple in Santa Cruz, they worked with the World Jewish Federation to find a place where they could go and really volunteer their time. And they loved to travel. So it was definitely, that was one of their passions. And so through sort of trial and error over a few years, actually, they finally landed at this place called the Mercy Center in Klang Toei, which is a slum in Bangkok. And it's run by sort of like ex-Catholic priest, I guess, named Father Joe. And it's this really incredible place where he doesn't proselytize. So it's much more about saving children who have been abandoned or who are in horrible, horrible situations, rehabilitating them through love and education, and having that cycle repeat itself. And now that they've been around for, gosh, I think 30 plus years, they have teachers and also, you know, people who are looking after the children who grew up in the orphanage itself. So it's this incredible full life cycle that is, it's not about, you know, adopting out the orphans. They don't do adoption. It's about rehabilitating the community. And they're so incredibly ingrained in this community that, you know, they're the center of the community. And so my parents go over for about 2 months at a time. And my stepfather is a retired fire captain. And he, a lot of times firemen, getting back to the firemen, they have another skill. And his skill is woodworking. And so he built a wood shop for the older street kids to learn how to learn a skill, learn something that they could be marketable with and make a living. And so not only do they learn a skill, but they also build furniture for the orphanage. And the orphanage houses 250 children, but they also run schools around Bangkok that educate 2,500 kids. And so they build, you know, cubbies and tables and chairs and whatnot. My mother is an editor. She works for McGraw-Hill. Or used to work for McGraw-Hill. And so she teaches English to the preschoolers there. And so when we came over, it was such an incredible experience because it's not about going in and saying and writing a check, you know, feeling sympathy and writing a check. It's about how can you contribute a skill from your life over a longer period of time. So again, they're pretty guarded about who they allow in because it's all about do you have the right intention and motivation? But they also, you know, they know sort of how the world works in the way of, you know, kids get attached. And so you don't want people flitting in and out and not and making a longer term commitment. And so we were able to be there for a month. And, you know, in the first day, Kevin went out and got all this wireless equipment and created a wireless network, their first ever working wireless network in the orphanage, which was like, he was like the messiah for the last four, you know, for the next 4 weeks. And I sort of had to try to compete with that in a way, but I was in the classroom and creating teaching plans for the first time and teaching English to these kids. And it was obviously an incredible experience. And just to pick yourself out of your life and drop yourself into such a foreign situation, it's incredibly eye-opening. I recommend it for everybody to do. And if you could take a month, that's great. It was a great break for us between, you know, jobs and starting Eventbrite for us to do that. And so we're very, very grateful, not only to my parents, but to the organization.
That was a great story. And what I appreciated most about it was the longitudinal perspective of this philanthropic organization. The idea that people can't just drop in and drop out because children get attached. I think that's so important. I was watching a really good documentary called Angels in the Dust. I rented it on Netflix, and it's about a South African orphanage that has essentially created a community of 500 people. And now a lot of the children, just with one couple, established this entire organization to help so many children whose parents have died of AIDS. Over 25 million children in Africa are orphaned now because of that disease. And so there's opportunity that abounds everywhere. And I think the longitudinal perspective of finding a philanthropy and having time over your life to stay with it is a neat idea that many people are realizing can work very well for them. You know, stealing those moments of time and just staying connected to a place over the years can be really powerful.
Right. And you can find different ways within your life to keep supporting them, even if you can't, you know,
remotely.
Be like friends and go over every year. Like we had our wedding registry, instead of gifts, we had donations sent to the Mercy Center. You know, for my 30th birthday, same thing. So through, again, social media, like causes on Facebook, I mean, you can really stay connected and with that network effect, continue your support.
That's awesome. Julia, thank you so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed having you. I'm really happy for your success. You and Kevin just sound like such an awesome couple to work together. You're doing great work in the world in so many ways. Thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thank you for having us, for having me.
And Kevin, by order of proxy. Awesome. All right. Well, I'm your host, Susan Bratton, and you've gotten to meet Julia Hartz, the co-founder of Eventbrite. And Dishy Mix fans, if you'd like to be the one who gets the free event, please come to DishyMixFan.com or the Dishy Mix Facebook page, and we'll make sure that one fabulous, deserving soul gets a great event from Eventbrite. All right. I will look forward to connecting with you next week. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.